From LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
This is the Artistic Heart Podcast, a podcast with an artistic heart and soul, with Anna Mead and Jack Wallen. Hello again, and welcome back to the Artistic Heart Podcast, the podcast with art and soul. My name is Jack Wallen, and I am here with
Anna Mead.
And we're going to talk to you today about a subject that is quite near and dear to our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And that subject is very simply, when is opinion truth, and when is truth an opinion?
Truth. Let's define truth, huh?
Sure. Go ahead. I've had it.
No, I want you to define it. I'm curious. This is your topic.
Okay. For me, truth is something that can be backed up by fact.
Hmm.
Truth is something that can be proved. Now, you have to understand that I'm very scientific in this. Because I'm one of those that have... I have numerous hemispheres in my brain, and I'm constantly working with them all at the same time. So I actually, at one point, somebody, I was in a discussion once with somebody about how the difference between men, how men and women think,
mm-hmm.
and how women think circularly and men think linearly. And I told them that I think in a figure eight.
Well, since gender is a construct, we should be okay, right? Like, let's all think in pinwheels.
Right, exactly. So I think truth is something, and it's truth is something that has become very, very important to society over the last 4 years. And we've
why?
Seen
has something
how,
happened?
No, nothing at all has happened. But we've seen how truth can be weaponized,
mm-hmm.
and you know, when you have people actually trying to say that something is a known lie, is a truth, there's a problem. There's a disconnect.
Right.
And when, you know, there are certain things I believe that society has to have in order to function properly. And one of those things is truth.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have truth, what can you base your life on?
Well, on the cheapening of scientific fact and truth, right, has led to a lot of issues, including our current pandemic, which,
right.
You know, if science, proven science facts are not taken as facts, then you end up with disaster.
Chaos. Exactly. You know, I think that's kind of where the problem lies for artists.
Hmm.
Is that the line between truth and opinion is so blurry.
It is.
And now I have a hard and fast rule. I'm gonna put on my writer hat for a second. I have a hard and fast rule about this. And I'm going to talk about it in terms of beta readers. Now, for those of you who aren't writers, what a beta reader does, at least for me in my process, after I have finished the first draft of a book and I reread it to proof it as well as I can, because I'm a writer, not an editor, and they are two completely different skills.
Oh, yes.
I then send that draft to beta readers. And I have a small stable of readers that are always willing to read my work. And I send it to them. And they know the drill. I'm looking for people to tell me if a story works,
mm-hmm.
if the character interactions are believable, if there are problems. Nothing about grammar or spelling or anything
right,
like that.
Right, because it's not an edited work.
It's not. It's not been right. edited. Now, some beta readers go ahead and point out mistakes anyway, even though they know
nice.
They don't have to. But they
I didn't need you to
they,
red pin it.
Right. But, you know, it's nice. It's actually kind of nice when they do that. And there's really just a couple of my regular beta readers that do that.
Mm-hmm.
And number one, I let them do that because they feel like they're helping me.
Sure.
And number two, it makes for an even cleaner manuscript to send to my editor.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes less work for my editor. But here's my hard and fast rule. If I have 5 beta readers that read a manuscript, and of those 5 people, one person says they have a problem with something, that's an opinion.
Okay.
If 3 people say they have the same problem with the manuscript, that's a fact.
I see.
Because...
So it's a corroborated opinion.
Exactly. And mm-hmm. these people don't speak to each other. They don't know each other.
Right.
So when all of a sudden 3 opinions, 3 people state the exact same opinion, I have to take that as fact and that I have a problem.
Well, because that's 60% of your beta readers, right?
Exactly. So. Exactly. Now, here's, it gets really interesting when I take my writer hat off and I put on my actor hat. Now I can do the same thing. I will say this, that as an actor, I don't read reviews.
And I mean, that's wise. Unless someone tells you it's glowing.
Right. Well, even then, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
First, I'll tell you why. What stopped me reading reviews? I did a performance of Midsummer Night's Dream with Colorado Shakespeare Festival. It was an absolute dream of a show
mm-hmm.
to do. It was directed by Joel Fink, who was just a brilliant director. And, you know, we had a 700-pound mirror ball on stage, and it was set in the 50s, and it was just amazing. But at the same performance, there were 2 reviewers in the audience. The first reviewer gave me the best review I'd ever had in my life. The second reviewer gave me the worst review I'd ever had in my life. So when I read those 2 reviews, it really hit me that all reviews are our opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I stopped reading them. So now here's the thing. Reviews can do the same thing as beta readers. If you get 5 reviews of a show and 3 of those reviewers have the same problem, then that could be construed as fact.
Right.
Or maybe not fact, because we're blurring the line.
It's still subjective, I think.
It's still subjective. Right. It's still an opinion.
It's just a popular subjective
exactly. thought. And at that point, though, as an actor, you have to step back and go, wait a second.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a problem? At which point you then go to the director and say, do I need to change something?
Right.
At that point, the director will either say yes or no. Now, here's another reason why I stopped reading reviews, whether they be good or bad. If you read a bad review, if you get a bad opinion about something,
it gets in your head.
It gets in your head and you're going to want to change it.
Right.
If you get a good review, a good opinion on something, it gets in your head. And guess what? You're going to start focusing on that good thing and it's going to change your performance.
Right.
And that's not what you want to. It's okay if a performance evolves.
Right. Change
naturally.
Because of external factors is a separate thing.
Yeah.
Right.
If your scene partner all of a sudden changes something, then you can allow that to make your allow that to evolve your performance.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't, if you all of a sudden go, hey, this reviewer really liked how I did this scene and did this specific thing in this specific scene, I'm going to do that thing even harder. Because if I do it more, they're going to like it even more.
Right.
And that's going to affect the show in a negative way. You don't want that.
No.
So, but the thing is that artists place so much weight on the opinions of others that they become fact.
Hmm.
That's dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And of course, we also have our inner monologue of what we think is truth about our own work,
right.
Which is often not true at all, right? Either way, either someone thinks they're a gift to the theater, right? And that's not true.
Right.
Or they think they are the worst person who ever trod the boards. And that's not true either.
Right. Yeah. You know, our opinion of ourselves can be our worst enemy and our best guide. But the problem is that it's just like this. Here's a perfect example of this. Now, because I have been recording audiobooks for a very long time, I'm used to listening. I'm used to how I sound.
Right.
I know how I sound to everybody else. The thing is that people that don't tend to do that sort of thing, the way they hear themselves is through their own head, which means they have all of these other resonators going on inside of their head that other people don't have. So you're hearing all this stuff buzzing about in your head mixed in with what your ears hear.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to sound different to you than you do everybody else. So when you hear a recording of yourself, you're like, whoa, that's not what I sound like to me.
Do you think that's why people hate the way they sound recorded?
Exactly. That is exactly why they hate the way they sound recorded, because they don't sound like themselves.
Right.
So the sound that you hear as you're speaking is an opinion. The sound everybody else hears is a fact.
Hmm.
And you can verify that by recording yourself and compare the two. Does the fact match the fiction or the opinion? Chances are it's not. There's going to be subtle differences. Sometimes the differences may be very subtle, but there will be differences. And, you know, it's hard.
is hard, Jack. If it wasn't hard, we wouldn't have a podcast.
Right.
And if all this was easy.
Right. I mean, is anything really easy in life anymore?
No.
And the older you get, the harder it gets.
Yeah.
But the thing is that as artists, we become kind of needy for these opinions. And
like
a little
hungry
less needy
for outside feedback.
Right. Mm-hmm. And we become a little less needy of fact.
Mm.
Or we become shy of fact. Or it's almost like we beg people to give us our opinion, give us their opinions.
Mm-hmm.
But don't make it fact. You know, I want to hear your opinion of me.
Unless it's bad.
Unless it's bad. You know, and that's, you know, it's just like after you watch a show and you have a friend in the show and
you hated it. Yeah.
And you have to go to that friend and
glad I'm here.
Right. I love your work.
Wow. It was such a thing.
Right. This is important, you know, and it's, we can't approach that friend with fact.
Hmm.
First and foremost, because it really is just your opinion.
Right.
And it's
hurtful.
Not fact.
It's not necessary. I always am truthful after shows.
Yes. Me too.
I just find sort of the most positive shine if it's not, you know, my favorite. Because not everything is for everyone. I mean, I think that's sort of clear when you were talking about the two reviews you got for Midsommar. I mean, maybe that person is not a huge Shakespeare fan. Maybe they are a huge Shakespeare fan, but they think Shakespeare should be a certain way, right?
Right, right.
Maybe
right.
It wasn't for them. That's okay.
Now, there is a certain level of fact that we can glean out of this. If somebody comes to you after a show and they say, you screwed up your lines in Act Two, that's a verifiable fact.
Sure.
Because you can actually go to the script and see, you said run away and it says leaving.
Hmm.
So that's a fact.
Has that happened to you?
No, not really. No, I don't think anybody's ever come to me to say you screwed up your line.
But yes, I mean, that's something verifiable, right?
That is something that's verifiable.
Right.
A director after a show can say, yeah, you screwed up your
block. You went upstage instead of downstage.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, and it gets really murky here, because as actors, we know what it means to upstage somebody. So you can be in a scene and you can completely upstage. And I don't necessarily mean, you know, scenery chewing kind of upstaging. You could literally physically be upstaging somebody.
Right.
And so somebody could come to you after a show and say, yeah, you were great, but man, that one scene, you were really upstaging that other actor. Now, were they talking about you chewing scenery, or were they talking about you standing upstage of that actor while they were delivering something that was important, wherein you should have been standing downstage of them so people could see them? So even within something like that, there's subtle differences. You know, one is a fact. The other is an opinion, because one audience member may have thought you were chewing scenery, and another audience member may have thought you were just really into the scene.
On point.
So there are so many shades of gray with this. And the problem is that we as artists tend to live in that little area between fact and fiction, often not knowing which one we want.
Mm. That's interesting, yeah. How do we tell people, I mean, what do we suggest as far as differentiating?
Okay, here's what I think. If I'm doing a show, or let's talk about books. Let's talk about writing, because okay. I think it's a little bit more concrete. If I write a book, and the book is published, and I can ask people, and I don't do this. I don't like to do this because I don't like to put this on other people's shoulders, but I can ask people, what did you think of the book? Or I can ask people specific questions. I can say, did this, like I do with my beta readers, did this story work? Did you find problems with this story? And I think the more specific questions you ask, the more likely you're going to get fact.
Mm-hmm.
And the more general questions you ask, the more likely you're going to get opinion. You know, did you like this story? That opens the door up for opinion. Did X work, or were you able to discern that I was trying to convey X in this scene? And the people reading the book say no.
Hmm.
Then you're veering a little bit towards, even though it's still opinion, you're veering a little bit towards fact.
Right.
Now, you know, as an actor, you can, after a show, you can ask questions like, hey, were you able to hear me?
That's key. If the audience can't hear you, yeah. It doesn't matter how good a performer
yeah.
you are.
This was important to me. The very, very, very first director I ever worked with back in high school, now understand this was high school, he said, the actor's first job is to be heard.
Hmm.
And that really, now, one of the reasons for that is the auditorium that we performed in seated 2,000 people.
Oh, my.
So it was huge. So we had to know how to project.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I learned how to project. So you can ask questions like that. And you know, but the problem is we actors don't want to know those questions. We want to know, and I'm just going to be honest here, and I'm not speaking for myself. We want to know, did you enjoy my work?
Right. What did I do good? Tell me how cute I am.
Yeah. You know, and I actually have on occasion after a show, I've said, what did you not like about my performance?
Mm, yeah. Well, that's more useful generally than like, oh, it's amazing.
Right. But at the same time, it is still opinion.
Right. Sure.
Even though you've asked somebody, what specific things did you not like about? Now, I've also had, you know, like let's say, for example, grad school, which is a completely different beast altogether. But after a performance in grad school, I would go to my acting teacher and say, were you able to see me applying the tools of the trade right. on stage? And if so, why was it obvious? And how can I make it such that it wasn't obvious?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's a difference between an artist asking for constructive criticism
oh, yeah.
versus acting asking someone to pat them on the back.
some of my favorite directors are the ones who have pushed me very hard, right? Mm-hmm. Not abusively, hard though, right. And that I can go to and be like, okay, what can I fix? And if I go to a director and they say, what can I fix? And they're like, oh, you're doing good. That to me is the least useful thing. I don't want that. I was like, tell me, maybe it's good. I'd like it to be as good as possible.
Right. I want directors that will push me as hard as I push myself. Mm-hmm. It really is that simple.
And that's true of conductors and choreographers. Conductors,
yes. And editors too. And, right. I have had editors in my writing career that have just, you know, marked up a document and sent it back to me. And then I've had editors that have given me lessons in their comments.
A good editor can change a book for good forever.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, it really is that old adage, you can give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day. You can teach a man to fish and he'll eat the rest of his life. Those editors that go out of their way to teach me something, especially something that I do wrong repeatedly. It's not just about them saying, oh my gosh, I've got to teach them how to teach this person how to do this so that I don't have to work so hard. I've had those editors that really just want to not just help the story become better, but help me become a better writer. And I respect that so much. And, you know, and within the world of writing, there are facts. There are very factual guidelines that, you know, how to craft a perfect sentence and a perfect paragraph. And oh my God, recently I've been diving down this rabbit hole of the golden ratio and trying to apply it to writing.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
I would say that as far as the perfect sentence for you, right?
Yes.
Because there's the perfect sentence written by Fitzgerald and the perfect sentence written by Shakespeare.
Right.
And the perfect sentence written by Joyce, which I wouldn't agree is perfect, but that's a separate conversation. But for your writing, what is the perfect construction for you? Right. What's going to make it sing?
And that's a very good point. And, you know, after you've worked with one editor for a certain amount of time, they all of a sudden get to know your voice and your style, and they're going to stop trying to edit your work such that you're writing the perfect sentence for them and you're writing it for you, you know. And I've had the editor that I work with now is such that she and I have worked together long enough that she can actually write in my voice. Nice. She can edit in my voice.
Right.
And I know that's not always easy. But that's another section where opinion and fact just blur together so much, because she's dealing with the fact of grammar and then having to blend that with the opinion of my voice, of my writing voice. And she has to go, okay, how can I make this sentence still sound like this writer, yet be as close to fact, factually accurate, within the writing style, you know, within the Chicago writing guide or whatever.
Chicago.
Yeah. Whatever you want. You know, I told you I'm not an editor.
I am. So, it can be challenging.
Yeah. And, you know, I want, as a writer, I want that blend. I want that blend of fact and opinion.
Well, she helps you find your authenticity, right? Which is what we are all seeking.
Exactly. And I think that there are times, actually more often than not, that authenticity is more important in art than fact.
So what do you do about authenticity that is actually the opposite of fact, right? In order to be true to whatever you're doing, it is obviously not factual, right? It is
That's
subjective.
Okay, I have a great example. There is a play that I adore by Brecht called The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy.
Yes, I've heard of it, yeah.
It takes, for those that don't know, it takes a very Hitler-esque character and places him in the 1920s Chicago greengrocer trade. And what they do is they take this Hitler character, or they take this person, and they want to use this person to get to kind of get their way within the greengrocer industry. And in the process of guiding this character, they turn that character into Hitler.
Hmm.
So what they've done, if you are an historian and you watch this show, it will drive you crazy.
Oh, sure.
If you are a lover of metaphor and analogy, you will love the play.
Hmm.
Because it takes an historical character out of context. And what happens is that you succeed when you are honest and authentic with that character within the realm of the world of the play. So instead of being authentic with Hitler as he was
in
Nazi Germany, you're being authentic to Hitler as it applies to the Chicago greengrocer trade of 1920. And what it becomes is a comedy.
Right. Maybe a larger conversation about fascism.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So there are ways that you can be authentic without being factual.
So we've kind of circled back, haven't we? Okay.
Yeah.
So truth and opinion and truth, not always the same.
No.
Neither is authenticity and truth always. Right. So how do we align our compass?
Well, as an actor, you align your compass with the director.
Mm-hmm.
And if the director is looking for fact over authenticity, then you give them fact. If the director is looking for something authentic that is factually inaccurate,
mm-hmm.
then you give them that. Or if the play is written in such a way, such like a farce, that is factually inaccurate, then you still have to be authentic to what the playwright wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And this gets kind of gray when you have, let's say you take Shakespeare, and how many different versions of Romeo and Juliet have there been? And you as a director, you decide, I'm going to set Romeo and Juliet in the time where the New York Dolls in New York were at the height of their popularity. And we're going to have, a punk and a prep. And we're going to do that. And that's factually, it's just wrong. It's just inaccurate. That's not how Shakespeare wrote the play. But at the same time, it's open to interpretation.
Yeah, I kind of want to see that production now.
Yeah.
I'd probably be less annoyed with the lovers, but
probably, yeah. So, you know, I think as an actor, it is, you are beholden to be authentic to the director's vision.
Mm-hmm. And to the character as you see them.
Exactly.
Right.
And as a writer, you are beholden to be authentic to the universe that you've created. And of course, you still have to be authentic to fact.
Right.
You know, you can't, I mean, unless you're writing something that is absolutely and 100% a complete fabrication from your imagination. But even then, there's facts are still going to play into it. Now, you can still break the rules. You know, you can have a science fiction book that exists entirely in space, and all of a sudden, you know, these space people, you know, these astronauts, there is no up and down for them. There's only gravity or a lack of gravity. So, you know, even then, you still have artistic license with truth.
It's interesting you bring up science fiction, because that is one of those weird trip things, right? Where it's like someone can write science fiction and not actually get the science right,
yes,
but make an
exactly.
amazing story.
Right.
And you can write science fiction that is absolutely 100% accurate and is dull.
I have read both of those.
Mm-hmm, me too.
There's another thing, and I don't think I mentioned this last time. I can't remember because life blurs together for me. I have the very first book I wrote is called A Blade Away, and it is a crime thriller that is set here in Louisville.
Yeah,
and it became a series called the Fringe Killer series.
Mm-hmm.
And that first book, A Blade Away, was inspired. I had a dear friend of mine who was transgendered, mm-hmm. and he asked me to attend a transgendered meeting with him because he was very nervous. So I said, "Oh, sure, I'll go with you." So I was there as support for him. And I sat in on this meeting and became very touched with these people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And they became very important to me. And I wanted to write a book that was that highlighted that group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it wound up being a pretty brutal, you know, thriller that illustrated the struggles that they had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And the intent of that book and the series was not to be a procedural. It was intended to be a crime thriller about people relating to one another. It was all about the relationships and the characters and not about the process. And the thing is it's really hard to write a crime thriller that is accepted in certain audience, in certain circles, because they only want procedurals. And if the thing is I tried. At one point, I was like, okay, let's try to make it more procedural. And I started reading all of these books about procedures. Like, there's just way too much. And I'm not a cop. And I'm not a detective. So I don't know these rules like I know all of the other rules in life. So you have to go, at some point, you have to say, okay, I can't successfully merge my artistic wants and my abilities with this need to be that honest and truthful to the minutiae of procedural crime thrillers.
Right.
So that's not what I'm going to write. But there are some people that when they read a crime thriller, they want that fact. And if you can't deliver it, why try? You shouldn't try. Because you're going to fail. I am met with silence.
Well, I was just sort of chewing that over. I mean, I think that so much of what we do gets complicated, right? Because
yes.
we overthink things, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are so many layers to the art we create, and we want right. to be both accurate and authentic.
Right. And that's important, because here's the thing. Writers are not omnipotent.
No.
They're not omniscient.
No.
We're not. So we have our limitations. And it's important as a writer, as an artist, period,
mm-hmm.
to know your limitations. To know so that I can step back and say, you know what? I don't know enough about procedural drama that I can't write it successfully. So I'm not going to try.
Mm.
Because at that point, I can craft an opinion about something in that realm, and I'm going to be wrong.
Hmm.
And if I can bring fact to that table, then I'm ahead of myself, but I can't. So I need to go, this is my limitation.
Hmm.
And in order for me to be authentic to that, I have to know more. That's a fact.
Well, and when we talk about authenticity, it makes me think of when I played Sylvie in The Nance. She was a burlesque dancer
mm-hmm.
in the 30s. And I am not a burlesque dancer.
Right, right.
And one of my greatest struggles, like many people, I have body image issues.
Yes.
And taking off my clothes on stage in the setting of the play and being as confident as I knew she would be, because that was her career. That was her job. She didn't think anything about it. I thought about it a lot.
right. Yes.
I think about, in order to be authentic to Sylvie, I had to almost completely unlearn every single thing that I had ever told myself about appearance and what is sexy and what we need to be in our bodies, right?
Right. Well, that also can be applied to another aspect of what you were talking about. I am an actor who moves.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a dancer who acts. That's fact. You can put me on a stage and we can find out very quickly the limitations of my ability to dance.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat.
And, you know, I can, you know, if a choreographer gives me the moves, I can pull them off to a certain extent. And when we were doing cabaret, you know, the choreography would bust through a few moves and I'd be like, oh, okay.
Can you do that in slow
motion? I'm
going to
need some time on this. And, you know, and fortunately, the choreographer was very understanding and very patient with me. And it took a while to get there, but I got there and I was having to work constantly.
Right.
And, you know, and it's a shame because I studied a lot of movement techniques and a lot of movement in graduate school. And I should be able to dance better than I do. But, you know, my body isn't trained for that.
Well,
that's fact. That's not opinion. That's
right.
Fact.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's the other thing is I'm 5'4". That's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I there are roles that I would love to play, but that one fact prevents me from playing them.
If it makes you feel better, I was never able to play the ingenue because I'm 5'9½".
Right.
So I was always taller than the hero. And now that I'm old, I can just play the hag and be whatever height I want.
But that's something important for actors to understand, is that there are facts about yourself that you have to come to grips with.
Right. You can't change.
It may be fact that you will never play the ingenue.
I don't know that was as much of a loss as I thought it was at the time.
No. When you're young, it's a huge loss. But as you get older, you realize that there are just a heck of a lot more parts for character actors than there are for ingenues.
Right.
You know, and
I was tired of batting my eyes anyway.
Exactly. But that's just something important, you know, and my height has kept me from playing roles that I would like to play. And then there are directors that have cast me anyway and worked around it and realized at some, you know, at some point it's like, wow, you're short. It's like, yeah, you kind of knew that.
Is that a surprise or have you met me?
I don't wear lifts when I go to auditions. I really don't. So, you know, fact and opinion is, you know, I could say it's an opinion that I'm not a great singer.
That is a wrong opinion. I've seen you sing. That is nonsense.
It's a fact that I can sing. I can produce tones. It's a fact that I can memorize lines.
That is different.
Right. I know. It's a fact that I can memorize lines. It's also a fact that it takes me a really long time to memorize lines.
Longer than it used to.
Right. And it gets harder as you get older. Whoa. I was about to announce something, but I can't. I can't do it yet.
Oh, we'll save it for another episode. Yeah. I'm sure people are really listening with bated breath to find out all of our new exciting stuff.
Which are few and far between right now.
We're fabulous. Well, let's wrap up. So what are the last words that you would say on this topic to sort of leave our listeners with?
That sometimes being authentic is more important than being factual as an artist.
Like that. Yeah.
And if you get caught up in being factual or get caught up in an opinion, then you're diving down a rabbit hole that's going to take you into very dark places that you might not want to be in.
Yeah. Not into Wonderland. We've all been in.
What's that?
Not into Wonderland.
No, because it's not a wonder.
No.
Not at all. Well, thank you everyone for listening to us again.
Thank you. We love you.
And we do. We do. And we hope that you have learned something or at least laughed about something.
Mm.
And we will be back again very soon with another topic and bring to you the soul of art. The Artistic Heart Podcast is produced by Anna Mead and me, Jack Wallen. It's distributed by Louisville Public Media. Our theme song was written and performed by Craig Waits. To suggest a topic or ask questions, feel free to reach us on Twitter at either JL Wallen or RUAnna3.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.